Hello, Hugh. It's nice to be here. Looking forward to Sam's class tonight on the unjust steward. Yes, so for those that might be at home, Luke chapter 16, verses 1 to 14 is going to be our readings.
Hello.
Hello.
So what is a parable?
What is a parable? Story with hidden meaning. Excellent work, Catherine.
Story with a hidden meaning. So we can often fall in the trap of thinking they're fairly simple stories, and often they are, but I think this is an example of one that's not quite as simple as we might expect from the parables. I've heard lots of different explanations during my 51 years upon this earth of this chapter, with most of which I sort of found had a high degree of convolutedness and a low degree of convincingness. So if you get the symbolism wrong, you sort of wind up in some pretty odd places, especially when you get to the sort of lesson for us bit of it. So when he says in verse 9, you know, it sounds like, you know, God is commending something for doing something unjust in that verse, doesn't he? He says, you know, it's a wise thing to do. And in verse 8 and 9 particularly, so, and Jesus sort of says, you know, make yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. So is he sort of advocating friendship with the world? And it sort of sounds like that's the path to eternal salvation with the term everlasting habitations there too. So, you know, that sounds like that's what Jesus is advocating. But we can probably assume that that's not true. So parables are generally very simple stories, but the meaning is often a bit more profound than perhaps we think. And so, yeah, we're going to go through this one tonight and come to my conclusion of what I think it means, and then you can disagree with me. So Luke does have a habit of putting things together. Things flow on from what happened before or flow onto what happens afterwards, and that sort of explains things. So the context is all important. So what's the context of Luke chapter 16? It's not a trick question. Yes, Luke chapter 15 is the context of Luke chapter 16. But because, you know, this parable starts at the beginning of Luke 16, obviously there's a chapter break in the middle of it, and we can often miss that context because it's in the previous chapter. But it is the parable of the prodigal son, and we know that parable pretty well, hopefully. So how many parables are there in Luke 15?
Three.
All the parables of the lost. Okay, so we've got these three parables of the lost. But the last parable of the lost takes up, you know, two-thirds of the chapter. It's by, you know, far and away the biggest of them. And there's heaps of lessons to be learnt from the parable of the prodigal son. But I think there's one particular lesson from the parable of the prodigal son that Jesus is then expanding on when he starts in the parable of the unjust steward in Luke chapter 16. So how many sons are there in the parable of the prodigal son? Two. Okay, so it's called the parable of the prodigal son. We call it that. What does prodigal mean?
Wasteful.
Excellent. Sue? So yes, wasteful. It's the wasteful son, but there's two sons in the parable, isn't there? So there's the younger son and the older son, which is what they're called in Luke chapter 15. So two sons, how many fathers? Two? Interesting. Yes, there sort of is. There's really only one father, but there's definitely two different views of that father, isn't there? So come back to Luke chapter 15 and have a look at Luke chapter 15 and verse 12. So and here we're going to look at the view of the father of the younger son. Verse 12, James, you haven't read yet, have you? No.
The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the estate that will belong to me." So he divided his assets between them.
Okay, so Luke 15, verse 12, you know, the father represents God. What sort of father is our God? He's a giving father, isn't he? So it says the younger son says, "Father, give me the portion of goods that belongs to me." And the father gives it to him, doesn't he? He doesn't sort of say, ask any questions. He doesn't say, you know, what are you going to do with it? Or, you know, you can have it a bit later when you prove yourself to be responsible. The father gives to the son, and he gives freely, doesn't he? So, and of course, we know that our father's done that with us too, hasn't he? Romans 8, verse 32, he that spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? So our Father's given us a lot of blessings, you know, life, his word, his creation to enjoy, houses, food, friends, ecclesias. But above all, Paul says in Romans 8, he's given us his son, hasn't he? And he's given us through his son salvation, as James mentioned in his prayer. We don't work for it. We ask for it, and he gives it to us. He is giving. He is a giving father. And he's forgiving too, isn't he? So next read it. What's your name, Emily? So Luke chapter 15, verse 20 and 22, please.
So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.
Okay, so not only is he giving, this father, but he's also forgiving, isn't he? The younger son wastes everything that his father's given to him, as we can often do with what God's given to us. But does his father hold it over him? Does he reject him on his return? No, he's sort of out there waiting for him, isn't he, to come back. He forgives him as soon as he turns back on the family doorstep. So that's our God, isn't it? That's our Father. He is giving and forgiving. But the older son doesn't see him that way, does he? Let's have a look at verse 29. Jeff, that must be you, I think.
But he answered his father, Look, these many years I have served you and never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends.
So this is the older son's main point, isn't it? You never gave me. You've never given me anything. In this case, a goat. You know, everyone loves making merry with a goat. You never gave me. So the father, the older son, does not see the father as giving and forgiving. In fact, he doesn't really see him as a father at all, does he? Because he says, again in verse 29, Lo, these many days do I serve. And the Greek word for serve is the word doulos, which you might be familiar with. It means a slave. These many years do I slave thee. I'm not your son. I'm your servant. I'm your slave, says this older brother. And I'm, you know, a very poorly rewarded servant at that. So the older son doesn't see his father as giving and forgiving. He sees him as a taskmaster, doesn't he? So we've got one father, but two different views of that father. And you'll notice back in verse 29, he wants to make merry with his friends, but hasn't been able to do that. That's the same word, philos, friends, as Luke 16, verse 19. Luke 16, verse 9, sorry. So just note that connection. And in Luke chapter 15, verse 30, he calls the younger son to his father. He calls him your son. He doesn't call him my brother or, you know, your other son. It's as though the father only has one son and it's not him. It's not the older son. So I think this is really the key of understanding the parable of the unjust steward. So Jesus takes that attitude, the attitude of the older son, the perception of God not as a father but as a taskmaster, and says, what does that mean? What if you do perceive God not as a father but as an employer? What then? What type of religion does that look like? What's the logical conclusion of that view of God? Where does that take you? And I think that's really what Jesus is doing in Luke 16 and the parable of the unjust steward, examining this wrong perception of God as the older son in the parable of the prodigal son has. What happens if that's our view of God? Where does that lead us? So God doesn't change, we know that, but our perception of God does change our relationship with God. And you might remember Russell Todd touched on that in a theme in an exhort last year. I think it was last year. But our perception of God changes our relationship with God. Is there evidence for this? Well, yes, there is. Thank you for asking. So Matthew chapter 25. So we might turn here because this is a pretty important parable as well. So this is the conclusion of the parable of the talents this time. So another parable. And I think we'll know it reasonably well. But in Matthew 25 and verse 24, we've got the conclusion of the parable of the talents. So you'll notice in verse 14 that the master gives his servants, 25 verse 14, Matthew 25 verse 14, he gives his servants a man travelling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered them unto them his goods. And he gave five talents unto one, he gave five talents, to another two, and to another one, etc., etc. So the master gave his servants talents, his goods, in verse 14. And while he's away, it's up to them, as we know, to use those talents as best they could. And those that used the talents wisely were richly rewarded on their master's return. But then we come to the guy who only got one talent in verse 24. What's his view of his master? And we know that the master in this parable represents God and or Christ. He says in verse 24, I knew you. So this is what he knows about God or Christ, that thou art an hard man, reaping where you had not sowed, gathering where you had not strawed. I know you. You're hard. You don't give anyone something for nothing. You expect everyone else to do all your work for you. You don't give, you just take. And that's, you know, completely ignoring what had happened in verse 14 and 15, where this this man had given his servants all these talents. So our perception of God changes our relationship with him. This was this man's view of his Lord, wasn't it? A completely wrong view of a master who distributed all his wealth among his servants. But he doesn't see God or Christ as giving, but taking, and not forgiving, but demanding. So what's Jesus' response to him? And notice how he uses his own logic, his own wrong perception of God or Christ against him in verse 26. So can you do verse 26 to 30 for us, please?
His Lord answered and said unto him, you wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents.
Yeah, that'll do. The story doesn't get better for that guy after that. So you can see in his perception of God or Christ in this parable, really. Because his perception of him is wrong, his relationship changes, and his master no longer gives to him but takes from him. So he gave to him back in verse 14 and 15, and now he's taking from him because this is a completely wrong perception of Christ, isn't it? So the parable starts with a man, you know, giving to his servants and finishes with him taking away from this wicked and slothful one. His perception of God, which was completely wrong, is a hard man who didn't, you know, give an inch to anyone, said, well, God says, well, I'll use that logic against you, or Christ says, I'll use that logic against you, and I'll take away what you already have because you haven't used it wisely. A couple of other quotes that suggest the same sort of thing. So if we perceive our God to be hard, we're going to treat our brothers and sisters and other people harshly. Psalm 18, 25 to 26, with the merciful, thou wilt show thyself merciful. With an upright man, thou wilt show thyself upright. With the pure, thou shalt show thyself pure. With the froward, thou shalt show thyself froward. And Proverbs 3:34, he scorneth the scorners, but he giveth grace to the lowly. So if you're a scorner, that's how God's going to treat you as well. So if we perceive God as a taking, demanding master, that's exactly how he's going to treat us. So that brings us back to Luke chapter 16 and the unjust steward. And I, again, believe that this is what Jesus is saying. What if your perception of God is not of a giving and forgiving father, but a demanding employer? What happens then? And that was obviously, as we'll see a bit later, exactly the perception that the Jews had of God, wasn't it? They saw him as a slave master to be obeyed, keep the laws, and God will reward you for that. They didn't see any grace or mercy being involved at all. So Luke 16, verse 1. There was a certain rich man which had a steward. So you'll notice... Oh, I'm still in Matthew. So the previous relationship that we're dealt with was a father with two sons. But now we're talking not about a man with a son, and not about a loving father with a son, but now we're talking about an employee, an employer, aren't we? And it's very much like the elder son perceived himself to be back in Luke chapter 15. So it's interesting, this is not a father-son relationship with all the sort of love and respect that that implies, but it's not a master-slave relationship either, is it? So God encourages us to see him as a father, and he also encourages us to see ourselves as voluntary slaves. So, you know, Romans chapter 6, know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves slaves to obey, his slaves ye are to whom you obey. So that's sort of two ends of a spectrum, which we're encouraged to view ourselves as. But a slave, of course, is wholly owned by his master. All his time, all his effort, his entire body is dedicated to the service of his master. And that's how we should be with our God and to his son. But this man, the steward, is neither a loved son nor a wholly dedicated slave, is he? He's a wage-earning manager. His time is his master's for as long as he pays him. And he's, you know, then he's free to do his own thing. He can have his own possessions, his own pursuits that aren't related to the master he serves. So the difference is really in the level of commitment, isn't it? A slave is fully committed, as we should be to our God. A steward, on the other hand, is only partly committed, isn't he? A steward's only, you know, 9 to 5 committed. So verse 1 again, there was a certain rich man. And I think this is sort of the first error that many people make when interpreting this parable. They assume that the rich man is God or Christ. But God is never called a rich man. He is rich, but he's never labelled as that. The father back in Luke chapter 15 was rich, but he's not called a certain rich man, is he? In the Bible, pretty much always, it's only bad guys that are called rich. So, and you'll notice down in verse 19 that the very next parable in this chapter begins in exactly the same way. So down in verse 19 of Luke 16, there was a certain rich man. Exactly the same phrase, but it's certainly not talking about God in that parable either. And it's not talking about a good person either. It's a bad man who does bad, selfish things with his wealth and is condemned for it. So if the certain rich man of verse 1 is not God and it's not Christ, then who is it? Well, I put it to you that it's the Jews, particularly at this stage, wrong perception of God. So just like the older son of Luke 15 didn't, you know, perceive God to be giving and forgiving like a father, but a demanding employer, so the Jews had changed their perception of God. They worshipped, you know, the God they worshipped was not the God of the Old Testament. He was not a father to them. He was a rich man. He was a demanding employer. And they perceived him as a source of wealth, you know, wealth they had to work for. And over time, the God they worshipped morphed from a source of wealth into the wealth itself. And they started essentially worshipping money as their God. Now, God is rich, we know that, and he wants us to want riches, but the wealth that he wants us to want is not cash, He wants us to want his grace, his mercy. That's what he wants to give us. And if we continue to see him as a God of grace and mercy, of giving and forgiving, then he will continue to be giving and forgiving. Now, he can, and he does give us other things as well, of course. And he'd given Israel so much more as well, hadn't he? You know, he'd given them a land and a temple, and yes, money, you know, gold, cash. But what did they want more of? Do they want more of God's grace and mercy, or do they want more of the money? So Ephesians 2, verse 4, God who is rich in what things? He's rich in mercy. For his great love, he's rich in love wherewith he has loved us. So he freely gives it to us. In verse 8 and 9 of that same chapter, for by grace, it's a free gift, you are saved through faith and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works. So it's not a, you know, employer-employee relationship we've got with God, lest any man should boast. So our perception of God changes our relationship with him. God acts as a father to us. He gives and he forgives, and we respond in service to him, don't we, because of his grace and mercy, because he is grace and mercy. But what if our motivation is not that, but it's our motivation for serving him is cash or things or, you know, stuff or possessions or you know, self-elevation or pride? What if we only serve him as an employer with a paycheck? What if you see your religion not as a whole of life thing, like a slave had to see his service, but as just a 9-to-5 job? What if you perceive your relationship with God not as receiving undeserved blessings, but as a quid pro quo relationship? God only gives me as much as I earn and no more. What happens then? Well, then, of course, the religion becomes less a process of salvation through grace and more of an enterprise. The God of the religion becomes not a loving father, but eventually the God itself becomes what they worship, a golden calf or cold, hard cash. So the Jews' religion, of course, had become literally a commercial enterprise, one out of this huge commercial property that they called the temple. The Roman Catholic Church has done exactly the same thing. Their religion has become, you know, this huge commercial enterprise run out of a beautiful church called St. Peter's Basilica. You know, could we do the same thing? Well, the Pentecostals, or at least some of the Pentecostals, I guess, have sort of trundled down that same path too, haven't they, with their prosperity gospel run out of their huge mega churches. What's this if not changing religion into a commercial enterprise, changing God from a giving and forgiving father into a source of cash until their God becomes cash itself? Now, back in Luke chapter 16 and verse 1, the steward starts out just like the younger son of Luke 15, doesn't he? He wants his father's law or his lord's. He wastes his father's or lord's goods. So the father in Luke 15, his goods get wasted by the younger son. The Lord in Luke 16 has his goods wasted by his steward. But instead of turning in humility to a, you know, giving and forgiving father like the younger son does in Luke 15, you know, he thinks there's no hope of his master forgiving him. So his perception of God is so warped that even though he knows he's wasted his goods, that, you know, God's never going to forgive him for that. His God, his Lord, his master is not a source of mercy as he perceives it, just of demands, just like the older son's wrong perception of his father in Luke chapter 15. So here's the proof, I think, that the Lord of Luke 16, or the certain rich man of Luke 16, is not God, not the God of the Bible at least, but what the Jews and later various branches of Christianity had turned God into. So come down to verse 10 of Luke 16, and here Jesus sets up two contrasting objects, doesn't he? The least and the much. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. He that is unjust in the least is unjust in much. And that sort of contrast continues in the next verse where the least and the much are explained. So he says, if therefore ye have not been faithful in the least, the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the much, the true riches? So the least is unrighteous mammon, you know, and mammon is just a word that's been transliterated straight from the Greek, I think, and it literally means possessions, money. And the much are the true riches, God's grace and mercy primarily. So can you see how he's sort of setting up down through these next few verses, verse 10, 11, 12 and 13, this comparison between the least and the much. The least are all the things of this world, cold hard cash at the end of the day for most people. And the much is what God has on offer, God's own riches, his grace effectively. And he's setting up this contrast between the two. So the contrast continues in verse 12 and 13. If you haven't been faithful in another man's, so that was the steward, hadn't been faithful in the rich man's goods, that's the least. Who will give you that which is your own, the much, which again is what God really offers to us. Verse 13, you can't serve two masters. And again, it's the least and the much. Who are the two masters? At the end of verse 13, it's mammon, who is the least, and it's God, who is much. So it's really this key contrast between these two ideas that sort of unlocks the ideas of this parable. The steward had been serving for the least because he was all about the cold hard cash, whereas his focus should have been on God himself, who offered him the much, the literal, you know, not the literal riches, but the spiritual riches of grace and mercy particularly. So it's important also to realise that the word for unrighteous in verse 9 is the same, essentially, word as unjust in verse 10. So it's twice in verse 10 and unrighteous in verse 11. And it's the same word as unjust in verse 8. So unjust in verse 8, unrighteous in verse 9, unjust in verse 10, which is twice in that verse, and unrighteous in verse 11, essentially all the same Greek word. It's probably worth somehow highlighting that fact in your Bible. So the steward was unjust, and he'd been using the unjust mammon, same word, to make friends, and he was unjust in the least thing. So it's all that same Greek word, adikia or adikos. So the unrighteous steward had been unrighteous in the least things, dealing with his master's money, and had used the unrighteous cash to make these other friends. So the servant was serving things that are least. He was serving mammon. And again, the word mammon's been transliterated. It literally means confidence. And again, it's normally money or wealth. But it can be all sorts of things that we can take confidence in other than, you know, our God. It can be power or prestige or authority over other people. You know, all these things that people can seek after while maintaining sort of this thin veneer of, you know, righteousness to cover up their motives. So I've used the example of money all through this, but I'm sure you can see how exactly that those other ideas also apply. So here's the point. The unjust steward had been unjust in the least things. What were the least things that he'd been unjust in? Well, they were his master's goods. His master is not God. His master is at least not the God of the Bible, you know, the father of Jesus, but his master had become mammon. He'd become, begun to worship money. That was his true master. Our God is whatever we worship, and the Jewish leaders had started worshipping money, mammon. That became their God, and commerce became their religion. So I realise that's a long and convoluted and slightly philosophical introduction, but let's have a look at now and what the parable is actually saying to us. So if we can accept that the steward is the sort of, in Jesus' day at least, the Jewish rulers of the day, and I think later on it's the apostate church who adopted the same philosophy. And the certain rich man is their perception of God and religion. So they're the older son of Luke 15. And we know that, you know, even from the time of Moses, many of them had not, you know, appreciated God as a giving and forgiving father, but they served him in fear down, you know, for the last 1,500 years, really, hadn't they? They'd served him as an employer, and eventually their God became what they worshipped in the end, which was money. So, and you'll notice we read down to verse 14 after the parable had stopped, because the Pharisees are picked out for us, you know, as soon as the parable ends in verse 14, just in case we had any doubts. It says in verse 14, the Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things and they derided him. The Pharisees, they're covetous. Who was their God? Cash ruled everything around them. So what about the other ruling class in Jesus' time? The Sadducees. They had command over the priesthood. They were, you know, rulers over the central, you know, worship system of the entire nation, based in the temple of God. And what was their view of God? They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in life after death. No reward from God. Life was literally, for the Sadducees, what you could get out of it here and now. So they were definitely, and as, you know, the priesthood was the Sadducees, who didn't, you know, who had this philosophy that life was for what you could get out of it now. So these men, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, had been placed in charge of God's house, of God's people, of God's land, of the temple itself. They were stewards over Israel. Well, what happens when your religion looks like this? Well, that's what Luke chapter 16, or the first half of it, is about. And they were accused, at the end of verse 1, of wasting the rich man's goods. Now, again, it's that echo back to Luke 15 and the younger son. The younger son wasted, same word in verse 13 of Luke 15, his father's substance with riotous living. And again, we all waste to an extent what we've received from God. God gives us all things, and we all to an extent waste his invaluable gifts. But because the younger son and we know that our Father is giving and forgiving, he can approach him and ask him for forgiveness, which is what he does and which is what we do. But the steward in Luke 16 doesn't have this view of his Lord, does he? He's the older son of Luke 15. So what's his response in verse 3? The steward said within himself, "What shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig. To beg I am ashamed." Now, you'll notice he doesn't protest his innocence. He doesn't say, you know, I didn't do it. He knows he has been wasting his Lord's goods. To beg, I'm ashamed. So his pride doesn't allow him to come on bended knee before the rich man. Now, the younger son of Luke 15 does exactly that to his father. He, you know, comes in humility back to his father, saying, you know, acknowledging his sin. And that's what God wants us to do as well, doesn't it? And the steward claims he can't dig, but, you know, of course he could dig. Anyone can dig. It's just that that work was beneath him, wasn't it? He could have humbled himself and, you know, fed swine like the youngest son in the previous chapter. But this steward's not prepared to be humble. And pride, of course, as we know, was the hallmark of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And their stewardship was about to be taken away from them. As verse 2 says, "Thou mayest no longer be steward." Verse 3, "My Lord taketh away from me the stewardship." Verse 4, "When I am put out of the stewardship." And about 40 years after Jesus has spoken these words, the Romans smashed their temple. The priesthood was defunct. You know, the subjects, the people they ruled over were scattered to all corners of the world. They were removed from their stewardship. So if your religion is commerce and your God is money, what's your logical, response to the imminent loss of your job? Well, you win friends by offering a cash discount. So you say to your the rich man's debtors, take your bill and write 50, or take your bill and write 40. So who did that? Who discounted their religion for cash? Matthew 15, verse 4 to 6. "For God commanded, saying, honour thy father and mother, and he that curses father and mother, let him die the death." That's God's commandment. "But ye say, whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, it is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, give me the money instead of giving it to your mother and father, and you're off scot-free. Take a discount, they said. It's cheaper to give us a small gift than to support your aging parents. Who else discounted their religion for cash? Well, the Roman Catholic Church did it directly, didn't they? They sold, literally, sold forgiveness. They sold indulgences in the Middle Ages, literally selling forgiveness, God's own, you know, prerogative, for cash. They discounted their religion for mammon. Pentecostal movement, I think it's not too dissimilar. Not all of them, but those that believe in the prosperity gospel. You know, what's the philosophy behind that? Give an amount of money to the church, you know, through tithing, and God, or you know, their view of God, is going to give you cash, heaps more cash in return. So discounted cash, and that was exactly the unjust steward's philosophy. Come down to verse 8 of Luke 16. And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. Now that's the end of the parable. The Lord here is not Jesus. It's the Lord of the steward. It's the rich man of verse 1. The steward had done wisely, not righteously, but logically. He hadn't done the right thing, but he had done the smart thing. He's acted according to the logic of his religion. And his God was mammon, and he would follow that wherever it led him. So that's the end of the parable. The Lord, the rich man of verse 1, commends the steward. He says that was a smart thing to do. It's not the right thing to do, not the righteous thing to do, but it is the smart thing to do. And then Jesus begins his commentary on the parable. So in verse 8, again, the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. So again, if you needed any further proof that the steward is a child of this world, he's not, you know, a child of light, he's not a follower of Jesus, he doesn't worship the God of the Bible, his perception of God is wrong, that the God he serves is money. He is a child of this world with all these that philosophy that follows with that. So what does Jesus say in verse 9? He is again explaining, I think, the logical outcome of the type of religion the Jews had adopted. What's the logical conclusion of a religion that worships not a loving father, but a demanding employer? The logical conclusion is get out of it what you can in this life. And Jesus says, you are going to fail. This type of religion will not save you. So in verse 9, Jesus says, if you're going to worship not the God of the Bible, but you're going to worship mammon or wealth or money, then use that unjust, unrighteous money to make friends. So use that to make friends, because when you're inevitably removed from your stewardship, those friends can receive you. So the King James Version has "receive you into everlasting habitations." And that sounds a bit like salvation, doesn't it? Sounds a bit like, you know, the mansions, the dwelling places of John chapter 14. But the word for habitations here literally means a tent. So it's the same word used in the New Testament of the tabernacle in the wilderness. So it's a tent, the opposite of a permanent dwelling. And the word everlasting is the Greek word aeon, which means an age, particularly eternal. But together these words don't mean eternal salvation or eternal life. So Hebrews 6 verse 6 uses the words eternal judgment. Matthew 3 verse 29 uses the term eternal damnation. So the friends that the unjust steward made were perhaps for eternity, or they'd always be there, but not in a positive way. The best they can offer is a tent to live out the rest of the steward's mortal life. Now you'll notice back in verse 4 that the steward had aimed to be invited into his friends' houses. So that's a different word. So in verse 4, the word house is the Greek word oikos, and the word steward that is used throughout the parable is the word, you know, oikonomos, from which we get the word economy. So So they're closely related words, the word house and the word for steward, oikos and oikonomos. So the steward's plan was that, you know, the people he'd discounted his lord's debts for would take him on as stewards for their house. But of course, there's no way that once they saw how he ripped off his, you know, previous employer, that they would take him on, you know, with the potential of doing the same to them. Instead, in verse 10, he's going to wind up not in a house, but an oikos, but in a tent, literally a cloth hut in the Greek. So that's how I would interpret that that verse in verse 9 of Luke 16. Your friends will not receive you into the houses that you'd hoped for back in verse 4, but there's always going to be tents waiting for you. They're always there. They're everlasting, but they're tents. They're temporary habitations awaiting you when your religion, your temple, your church is taken away from you. So the Pharisees and Sadducees had already sold out, hadn't they, their religion and their people. They'd sold them out to the Romans, and the Romans particularly were the friends that they gained using the wealth that they generated from their commercial religion. Right, so when they weren't busy attacking Christ, they were busy currying favour with the Romans because they knew that without Roman support, they would no longer be in positions of power, as they say in John chapter 12. So Jesus' commentary from verse 10 onwards is a series of contrasts, as we've already seen. It's a series of choices that we can make. Are we going to be faithful or unjust? Are we going to focus on the least or on the much? Are we going to serve God, a giving and forgiving Father, out of a love and a response to what is freely given us? Or are we going to become a servant to money? And money, again, mammon doesn't always have to be wealth, which is why I think he puts Luke 16 verse 18 in there a few verses later. Mammon is whatever we choose to dedicate our lives to instead of, you know, a whole body, soul and spirit worship of God himself. So if we choose God, our Heavenly Father, he will, in verse 12, give us that which is our own. We don't earn it like a wage earner. We serve him because he is loving and he gives us life, life eternal. So the mistake the Jews had made was that they tried to serve two masters. You can't do it, says Jesus, as he says in verse 13. He can't serve God and mammon. So what happened to them? Well, it started with a wrong perception of God, didn't it, way back in Exodus? They couldn't see that God was trying to be their father, that he was giving and forgiving. They could only see him as a demanding employer. Dr. Thomas wrote, I think that men become like the God they worship. So if your perception of God is a hard man, a demanding employer who will only pay what you're capable of earning, then that's the person you will become. The Jews hated the Romans, but the Pharisees and the Sadducees knew that the Romans were the only ones keeping them in power. They tried to serve two masters, but wound up hating their true Lord, and instead saying, "We have no king but Caesar." And finally, of course, God removed them from his temple and his land, and they spent the next 2,000 years in tents, wandering through particularly Europe. And one day soon, of course, we know that you know, Christ is also going to remove those, you know, church leaders who claim to serve in his name but are really serving for themselves, serving mammon. So what's the lesson for us out of this parable? And I guess it's more of a warning than anything, a warning for us not to follow that same path, the path of, you know, that the Jews went down, you know, the Catholics have gone down, and the believers in the prosperity gospel have gone down, or particularly the leaders of those religions. It's a warning to never lose sight of the God we worship, the God of the Bible, a giving and a forgiving Father. And if we do lose sight of him, if we replace him, you know, with mammon, what the outcome of that is going to be? Or even if we try and worship both God and mammon, the outcome is the same. Without God's grace and mercy, our religion becomes what we can get out of it now, what we can get out of it today. Our God becomes a demanding employer, And our reward becomes not eternal life, but the, you know, the temporary protection that in this life that the worship of money can bring. So how do we perceive God? Do we perceive him as a father? You know, that we are his children, that we are helpless without him, that he gives us everything like a father to a small child. We inherit from him, like the son in Luke chapter 15 did. We inherit from him because he is gracious and merciful and loving, and all that he has is ours. Or is he a taskmaster? Does he reap where he doesn't sow? You know, we've got some sort of quid pro quo relationship with him. Are we, you know, just labourers for wages in our perception of him? How do we see the ecclesia of God? Are we, you know, stewards of it for what we can get out of it now? Is it the praise of men that's our reward? Is it an enterprise? Is it just a, you know, money-making machine, an end in itself? Or is it a house of refuge, a place of rejoicing, a welcoming home, as it was for the younger son when he returned to it in Luke chapter 15. How we perceive God is going to affect our relationship with him. He has given, not made us earn, talents. If we think that he's a hard man, we might be tempted to wrap that talent in a napkin. You know, after all, what are we going to do with just one talent? If that's the case, God will take away that which he freely gives us, and he will become the hard man that we thought he was. Just a final quote from Romans chapter 11. For the gifts and calling of God are without repentance. For as ye in times past have not believed God, yet now have obtained mercy through there, that the Jews' unbelief, even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they may obtain mercy. For God hath concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counsellor, or who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again. For of him, and through him, and to him are all things, to whom be glory for ever. Amen.